You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.
Hey nerds, welcome to episode 493 of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast, presented by Overdrive. Just Adam for the introduction before I get to the interview that Jill and I did today with Anne Helen Peterson. Can't wait for you to take a listen to that. Anne, for a long time, was a senior culture writer for BuzzFeed until earlier this year when she began writing her own newsletter, which you can get at Substack. You can go to annehelen.substack.com if you want to subscribe to her newsletter. Highly recommend that you do. She's an extremely prolific journalist and writer who just has her kind of her finger on the pulse of culture and our society and the way that we're all feeling about things more than just about any other writer that I could think of. A few years back, she wrote The Rise and Reign of the Unruly Women, which was amazing. Joe and I are both big fans of that. And the book that we talk about a lot today in our conversation is called Can't Even. And it's all about how the millennial generation became completely burnt out by the amount of work that we do and the multiple jobs and all the stresses and everything. And just, it's a really deep dive into where the generation known as millennials that people like to joke around and think of as like teenagers, but in reality, the oldest millennials, you know, are close to 40 and starting families, and how our generation came to have the mindset that we did. And we didn't really, for this conversation, we didn't really prepare a whole bunch of questions, just because with this coming out the week of the United States election and this book feeling very timely with where the mental state of all of us are in the country, we just wanted to have a conversation. And I think it was really, really delightful. So I think you're going to enjoy it. It's funny, but serious. And we talk about mental health and how we all deal with anxiety and stress and just lots of great stuff. You're going to love this. I can't wait for you to take a listen. If you want to get a hold of us, you can always go to professionalbooknerds.com. There you'll find links to all of our previous episodes and all sorts of good stuff. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at ProBookNerds, and you can email us at ProfessionalBookNerds@Overdrive.com. Also, if you haven't done so yet, we'd love it if you leave us a quick 5-star rating and a review in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. We much appreciate that. And then also today kicks off the Big Library Read. So if you go to BigLibraryRead.com, you can borrow Reverie by Ryan LaSala, and you can join the discussion board. And then you can sign up for our event that we're doing Friday next week. That will be a whole lot of fun. Okay, I think that's all the housekeeping. I know there's a lot going on around here lately that we've been telling you about. But before we get to anything else, I'm just really, really excited for you to hear this conversation with Anne Helen Peterson on the Professional Book Nerds Podcast.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey, and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listener survey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
Hey everybody, it's Adam and Jill, and we are really, really, I guess excited is a tough word to use in this moment, because who's ever truly excited about any moment in real normal life here, but we're really jazzed to be joined by Anne Helen Peterson, who you might know from her years and years as one of the best and most frequent reporters for BuzzFeed. She is also an author of several incredible titles. The one that we're going to focus on right now, which just recently came out and is extremely prescient, is called Can't Even: How Millennials Became the Burnout Nation, which all three of us, I feel, are very comfortable talking about since it's our generation. We're going to get into all that and we'll just see where we go. So first off, Anne, thank you for joining us today.
My total pleasure.
So, it's funny. We can see each other on Zoom and like Joe and I are just staring at each other like, who's going to start talking first? do you want to kind of kick us off by explaining the book to our listeners so they have an idea of where this conversation is going to start?
Yeah. So it started as an essay that I wrote in January 2019 that was really the culmination of me like burning out really hard and not recognizing it as burnout, because like my understanding of burnout was that it was like when you collapse, right? Like then you're working so hard that you really collapse and that then you have to like quit your job and like go into the mountains for a year and come back to the world. And it was something that I thought like doctors got or foreign correspondents, you know, people in incredibly stress, like what we recognize as very explicitly stressful situations succumb to. And so over the course of that essay, I think I really tried to figure out what burnout looks like for millennials, which is mostly just like this background of precarity and instability and how our response to that instability has been to just work all the time. And some of that is like forcing yourself to work. Like if you're in a salary job, just like filling work into every crevice of your life in order to distinguish yourself in some way. And some of that is like trying to find three jobs plus like another side job to just keep above water. And that essay did well and I think resonated with a lot of people, and it was easy to translate it into a book just in terms of I went a lot deeper, both vertically in terms of like I went historically, like looked at a ton of economic history, child rearing history, sociological history, like trying to figure out what was going on in the United States, especially with our parents' generation, with boomers, and then what happened over the course of the 80s and 90s while millennials were growing up, to basically prime us for burnout. Like how was our path set for us? And then also I wanted to expand it horizontally in terms of really trying to get far more than just my like white middle class experience. So I talked to hundreds of millennials about how burnout accumulated differently according to location, race, class, immigration status, like all of these different components of identity that really texture how burnout works in your life. And so the book begins with like our burnt out parents and then travels through how work got shitty, how work stays shitty, how we arrived at the point that we have no hobbies, and then ends at millennials and parenting. Because that's something, you know, like there's all these jokes about like, oh, millennials, like people just use millennial as like a derogatory term to describe like teens. And the oldest millennials are 39, right? Like millennials have kids and are dealing
with yes, yeah.
parenting stresses. And so trying to think through some of the ways that becoming parents during this time has just really felt relentless. And the book, I finished it before COVID and it was in final copy edits, and then COVID hits and my editor's like, do you want to do anything? I guess I'll write, you know, I wanted to acknowledge COVID in some way. And I wrote a foreword that essentially says like, everything that I talk about in this book is just worse now. You know, like COVID just has made everything worse.
It's so true. You said like 600 things I'll talk about. Yeah, go ahead, Jill.
No, I was just going to say, speaking about this whole like millennial as this like catch-all phrase for young people, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be like 39. So I'm not entirely sure that fits. But yeah, COVID has definitely created this like extra layer of, it's hard to separate yourself from work even harder now. Mm-hmm. which I was not anticipating.
Yeah, I think, you know, and this is a good transition. My current book project, because I can't stop working, is about with my partner, who is a tech columnist for the New York Times. We are working on a book about working from home and how like all of the crappy things about work could so easily just get worse mm-hmm. with working from home in terms of the ways in which work spills over into these other parts of our lives, but also how we can think of work from home as a way to maybe, just maybe, decenter work from our lives, right? Like to kind of excavate a place, a non-work self and a non-work space in the post-COVID times. And it's been an interesting kind of experiment in terms of like, I oscillate between like, oh, work from home is going to screw us all, or work from home might be something if we do it deliberately, that could be really liberatory.
Well, and it's really interesting because it's almost like a psychological thing. We're like, so for my, I live in a townhome, and the main living area in this house is my living room, my like kitchen, and then where in theory we would eat dinner, but where we eat dinner now is also where we work. And so right. at any given time during the day, I can see my laptop. And yep. so it's like, I'll be cooking dinner and I can see it. And if I like, God forbid, I have the sound turned on and I get an email or a Slack message and I go over and I look at it, and, or if I'm sitting on the couch in like the 1 minute a day that I consider trying to relax, which like I told Jill reading your book, I was just like nodding my head in agreement. Like, yeah, I feel all, oh my God, she's like in my brain. I just see my computer and I start to feel guilty of like, because we know that we're very privileged in the sense that we work for a digital company. We're providing ebooks and audiobooks for people to be able to enjoy while they're safely at home. Like if there's ever been a company that was ready to help people during this time, it's ours. So we've had so many less stresses than other people, but at the same time, it creates this psychology of being like, okay, well, I'm fortunate to have a stable job right now because of the situation. So I always need to be working. And it's been, I will freely admit, I have no work-life separation whatsoever now.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is something, and I try to get to this a bit in the book, right? Is I think that oftentimes white middle-class people tread this difficult line of like, we need to absolutely like always be cognizant of the ways that like, oh, you know, all of these problems that we have and all of these like burnout situations that we're talking about in the book, we can throw money at them. Right? Mm-hmm. Like as psychologically taxing as all of this has been, we've been able to work from home and not have to bear the psychological burden of like every day, am I going to mm-hmm. get COVID? Am I going to expose someone? Am I going to kill my grandma? Like mm-hmm. those sorts of things. But also, how do you keep that in mind? Well, admitting and being honest with yourself and others about how hard it is. Right. Yeah. Like there's this incrementalism that I think happens. And like, I talk about this a little bit explicitly in the parenting chapter, where a lot of times moms are like, well, my husband does more than this husband, so I can't complain. Mm. Right. Or I've been able to keep my job, so I can't complain. But what that does is that it prevents us from like seeing how there are similarities between all of the things that suck, right? Like you can acknowledge the fine gradations and how different mm-hmm. the struggles are, while also being like, we're in this together. And only by us like all taking our anger at how things are, putting that into like one big cauldron, like that's mm-hmm. how it's going to bubble over and we're actually going to change. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. I think also, and maybe this just might be like an internal thing for just me, or if this might be, I think it's like a combination of like the millennial aspect, like you said, like always needing to feel like we're working, and also with everything going on at COVID, it's like, I feel like I've lost my capability to celebrate any victories whatsoever. Yeah. Like like last week, our podcast, they're gonna, speaking of BuzzFeed, where we used to work, like we were mentioned as like, you know, one of their favorite literary podcasts. And like, I saw that and I sent it to Jill and we were both like, woo, like literally gave it like 4 seconds of thought and I sent right. it to our director. And then right. I moved on with my life and I was like, that was a cool thing. Or like seeing like all the, I feel like I've lost my complete ability to feel like we deserve to celebrate mm-hmm. anything. And I think it's a combination of a working millennial during the pandemic, when it's just like, well, if I celebrate this thing for more than a minute, then the next thing I'm supposed to be working on isn't going to get done.
Right. Well, and you're only as good as the last thing that you've done, right?
Right.
Right. Yeah. Like, you can't write on your laurels in any way. Like, that is not acceptable. I also think, you know, the inability to feel any sort of achievement or catharsis is such a symptom of burnout. Like, it is a thing that you're just trying to get through one item on your to-do list after another. And that includes, you know, everything from a birthday to like taking out the trash, like everything just flattens. Mm-hmm. And so there's no peaks and there's no valleys. And I often think back to college of like that feeling of studying so hard for your final exam or your final paper or whatever. And you would work so hard leading up to finals and like leave it all on the table, right? Like, you would just do everything that you could and you would exhaust yourself. And then it would be over, right? You would go home, and I always got sick because I was like letting down my guard, you know? And even if like I would always babysit or like do odd jobs at home, I wasn't doing that intellectual work. I had a real and actual recovery and a real catharsis that prepared me to re-enter with the new semester. Like, I would be so excited for the new mm-hmm. semester. But like, life and work is so relentless and so overwhelming that there is no place in our days, let alone like even a weekend. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know how is a weekend different than the rest of my days these days, right?
Yeah. I remember something I've struggled with and I still struggle with, and it's probably a combination of like burnout, but also anxiety, which is also tied in. But I get to work on Mondays and I feel like I have to do everything for the entire week in like the first hour of the day, because I don't know like what is going to come down. There's just this like sense of urgency of having to get stuff done, because there's always going to be something else. And it feels like there's no end in sight. Which is not true. That's not always what my workday looks like, but there's that sense of needing to be prepared, because I always like there could be another whatever around the corner that just throws everything up in upheaval.
Well, and that's a very millennial stance, is like, the shit's gonna hit the fan at any second.
Yep.
And because it did, you know, we graduated from high school or from college directly into the aftermath of the Great Recession. Like, things have been shit for a long time, and we were just gaining stability as a generation as COVID hit.
Mm-hmm.
So like, for most millennials I know, they were like, oh, of course, right? Like, just as I was starting to feel solid in some way in my job, in my role as a parent or a partner, in my like financial cushion that we're all supposed to somehow accumulate, paying off my student debts, whatever, it all falls apart. And so I think our work and our work ethic is really designed to kind of create a cushion. Or the other thing that I found myself using all the time when I was describing what happened, how I like left academia to start writing for BuzzFeed, is I always used to say I was building myself a life raft while I was in academia by writing online for very little money. But I was essentially like subconsciously figuring out a different strategy for when everything fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And like that, if you're always looking for a job or thinking about what you're going to do if your job goes away next week, it's a really psychologically taxing stance to take. And I think it's difficult for people who are salaried and are accustomed to like, companies lay people off all the time and disappear. And it's just as arduous in a different way for people who are like working retail jobs and are like, what's my schedule going to be next week? I have no idea. It's set differently every week. Is my store going to close because of COVID? Like, am I going to have an income? You know, that sort of inability to make any sort of short-term plans takes its toll.
I'm curious, and this is kind of actually for both of you. I'm curious for both of you guys' thoughts on this. So something I've noticed really throughout like all of working but especially in this past year, is like the things that I find passion in. I feel like all three of us are probably very fortunate. Like, I know one of my big passions is literature and reading and writing. I work at a company that is involved with that, Jill, as well. And I know that you obviously have a passion for writing and you know, commenting on culture and society, since that's what you've been doing this whole time. But what I've found now is, like, people who have listened to the podcast for a while know that, like, Jill and I have other jobs. This is not like our job. It's not in our job description. We just happen to be doing this in addition to it. And we're like, I can't remember the last time I picked up a book that wasn't for the podcast. And like, we're fortunate we kind of get to pick and choose who we talk to. So I'm very interested in the books I read still, but like, I can't remember the last time I've picked up a book where I'm like, I'm just going to read this in bed tonight because I want to read X, Y, or Z. Or like, it's so rare for me to write like a short story just to write it, because I feel like I should be working on like the book that I'm trying to write. And I'm curious for you too. Like, I know, Jill, you are working on your third and fourth books, and you just said you're working on your next book. Like, are you, either of you, able to find enjoyment in the things that you enjoy, or do you feel like you need to be doing it working towards a goal as opposed to just purely enjoying it?
I mean, part of this has to do with the very millennial tendency to turn what you like doing into your job. Yeah. Right? Like, and we were inundated with that idea, you know, do what you love and you'll never work another day for the rest of your life, which my chapter in the book is do what you love and you'll work every day for the rest of your life. And I think that oftentimes, you know, we are lucky ones that we have been able to take what we love and turn it into something that is full-time employment. Whereas lots of people with that maxim in mind struggle to find anything approximating, you know, stable employment. They're like, oh, of course I should get paid crap for this. And the happiest people that I've talked to are one in terms of like finding time for things that they love and that sort of thing, is ones who went down that road for a while, found that it didn't work, found a job, like a J-O-B job that is just 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. And now they do the thing that they actually love on the side.
Yeah.
And sometimes they do it for pay and sometimes they don't, but it is definitely on the side.
That, yeah. I always say that even if I were to like magically become some like huge bestseller, I need to have a job both for structure and stability, because of that millennial thing of being like, I like health insurance, I like having a steady paycheck, things might happen. So I need a job. But yeah, I do it on the side. And I'm very good about setting boundaries of like, this is my work time and this is not my work time. And that's just sort of a personality thing, I think. But yeah, everything I do for writing wise is like on the side. Although admittedly, in the middle of the pandemic, it's been a struggle, I think, for a lot of creatives. And some people have been able to create through it, and I have not, but I sort of have to now. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge, but it's definitely a side thing.
One of the things I've been thinking about a lot is what stability allows to flourish,
mm-hmm.
right? It allows you to flourish as a parent. It allows you to flourish as a creative. It allows you to flourish as a member of your community, because you are not constantly just worried about treading, like keeping yourself and your immediate circle,
mm-hmm.
your heads above water. And so obviously COVID has rendered so many things unstable, but even before that, and the big thing about the book is like the structure of American society right now is just fundamentally unstable for the vast majority of people. And so all of the things that we're doing, all of these coping strategies from overwork to phone addiction, like there's just so many things that over-parenting and like obsession with parenting, they are all reactions to that instability. And sometimes those reactions are really freaking dark and like racist and xenophobic and really prop up pretty horrible understandings of what the family should be, what we should be as a country. But I think more and more people are really reacting in a way that's like, this is unsustainable. Mm-hmm. Like, we cannot keep doing this. Something has to give. I'm so mad. And I'm grateful, which is the wrong word. I am, the one thing about the pandemic that is useful is that I think it is really consolidating that rage in a way that I think you can point it towards something.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's almost like, I feel like if I find a thing that somewhat reduces that rage in my body for a little bit, and this all gets back to like being a millennial, I feel like I have to justify even that minute, like that bit of enjoyment. I'm like, I really like that David Letterman show on Netflix, like My Next Guest needs no introduction, I think it's called. And like in my justification is like, well, I'll watch this and I'll enjoy it for 40 minutes. I'll watch him talk to Dave Chappelle, but I'm going to pay attention to how he does his interviewing because I don't deserve to be happy for 40 minutes. I have to be like,
so how, classic.
It's awful. And like, and I know it. And then I don't know. And then I even get like the subtle, like not needling, but like it comes from a good place. Like my mom, I am a pretty good cook, and I definitely lately, because I have nothing else to do, I'll like plate the food a nice way, and then I'll take a picture, and my mom will be like, you should try to make a cookbook. I'm like, can I just enjoy this one thing? And like, it's coming from a good place, but it's like, because of this pent up rage and everything that we're all feeling, I feel like I have to justify even like a modicum of happiness that I can enjoy during a day.
Yeah, well, and that's the symptom. Before we started taping, we were talking about listening to audiobooks, and I had a real problem before I like understood how my burnout worked with like always wanting to fill every space with a podcast. Mm-hmm. Be like, oh, I'm making dinner, podcast, I'm doing laundry, podcast, I'm taking the dogs for a walk, I should be listening to a podcast. And they were all like informative. It's like The Weeds from Vox, which is like the most wonky podcast, you know, stuff like that, that I thought was edifying me in some way. I really felt like I had to be spending that time in a way that would be like contributing to myself and to my ability to talk to others and to my job, and not giving myself any space, like giving my mind to just like hang out with itself is the phrase that I always use. And so like one shift I've made is to be very okay with like, I only listen to one podcast and it's very sporadic. You know, like I just like, I am no longer trying to keep up with the podcast rat race. I'm also no longer trying to keep up with the watch everything that you're supposed to be watching, right? Which like it used to be more of an imperative that I did because I was writing much more cultural, like straight up kind of like television film criticism, but I just gave up, and it feels very liberating.
I feel like I get that when I tell people that we host a podcast, but like in the book version, they'll be like, oh, well, tell me your favorite book from the past month. It's like when someone tells you that they're a comedian and it's like, tell me a joke. And like, I am very bad at that when it comes to books. Like I try to at least like be up to speed on everything so I can appease these people, but it is really, really hard. I'm like you, I definitely have headphones in at all times, if I'm running, if I'm walking the dogs, if I'm cooking, and I'm usually listening to an audiobook. So my mind, I'm like, I need to fill this space with something productive. I'm telling you, your book was eye-opening. It like made me actually like, it was like going to therapy with your book. I was like, oh my god, and sees into my spirit.
So many people have told me that the article or the book that they sent it to their therapists, and their therapists were like, every other millennial that I see also sent me that. And I think it's great that people are talking about it with their therapists, because a lot of these are problems that I think probably they were talking about in some way, and they just need more language to talk about, and therapy can be so helpful for that. But like one of the critiques of the book is that like, if you're feeling this, you just need more therapy. And that is, first of all, that's such a personal solution that I just fundamentally disagree with. I also come from a place where in North Idaho, where like therapy is just not available to people. Like, you know, my mom has been on a waiting list to see a therapist for like 3 months. And then she gets to see that person once every couple of months. It's not the same. So it can be a financial barrier and just an access barrier in so many ways. So to say like, oh, the way to fix millennial burnout is to like have everyone go see a therapist, I'm like, therapy is a great tool, but it is it is not the solution ultimately.
Right. And it sort of like misses that, again, like it's an access thing, whether it is financial or it is just geographical or whatever, that being able to go to therapy on a regular basis is definitely something that comes from a place of privilege. And a lot of millennials just don't have that option. And so that sort of misses kind of to like suggest that, like, I don't think you understood what you were reading.
Well, and some people are really good at not feeling the stuff that we feel. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy for them that like they can set those boundaries better, that their relationship with their Instagram account is not the same as my relationship with my Instagram account, you know, like that they have not internalized some of those ideas. Everyone is different. And I don't think every millennial necessarily feels that way, yeah. But enough of us do that it's worth talking about.
Ugh, I'm so jealous of those people. like I've been able to detach myself from Facebook at least. That's like one. Yeah. But then my issue is like for our job. Again, right. Jill and I are both in marketing and we host a podcast.
Right.
And so we do social media. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, well, I'm just going to look at the Professional Book Nerds podcast Twitter real quick. But then my little icon for my personal one is right there. And I'm like, well, let me just see what's going on in the world. And I'm angry. Like it just like, and then I'm just doom scrolling.
Yeah.
And like, I can feel myself. It'll be like 2 a.m. when I'm awake again with a dog or just insomnia and I'm scrolling through. And I like in my brain, I can feel my like internal monologue being like, shut your damn phone off. Not only is the doom scrolling bad, but the blue light is bad for you and you're just keeping yep. yourself awake. And I'm like, good point, internal self. But let me just refresh one more time and see if something horrible has happened.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that, you know, we're smart people. We know what's happening. You can see it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I'm having like burnout behaviors, like what you were just describing is what I think of as a burnout behavior.
Oh, yeah.
My like biggest burnout behavior at the beginning of the pandemic was I was just like so obsessed with this dumb Candy Crush knockoff that was like not satisfying in any way, but I could not freaking shake it. I was just like, I want to play this so bad, can't read, can't do anything but look at COVID numbers and play this game. But I was like, oh, this is a burnout behavior. And it just like, you can acknowledge it for what it is. And I try not to like get mad at myself. I'm like, okay, so here is what's going on. But I have another question because of our timing and because of what I'm thinking about right now. But I feel like I've tried to keep everything at an even keel and like everything's kind of falling apart. And I think that it is the week before the election. I think like just everyone like has been holding so much tension mm-hmm. that it's overflowing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the person who like said it best, his name's David Roth. He writes for Defector and he's been a freelance writer. I think he writes about Trump like as on point as anyone in the country. And he co-hosts their podcast called the Defector Podcast, very creative naming. And like their podcast last week, his co-host's like, hey Roth, how's it going? And he's like, oh, everything's terrible, but it's fine. And like the way he just said that and then they moved on. Yep. I was like, that's every one of us. That's being like it's fine meme with the fire around
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I don't know. I definitely know that that's adding stress. For people who are listening to this, we're recording it a week early. You will hear this on Monday, the day before the election, a super chill time to listen to a podcast. But I don't know, Joe, what do you think? Are you stressed now or always stressed?
Oh, I'm always stressed. We had this conversation like way back in March where I was like, oh, as someone who is always anxious and always is waiting for like the bottom to drop out, this is just like another thing. Mm-hmm. And I have learned over several years that I react to trauma in a very different way than other people do, in that I will freak out about really little minimal stuff, but very traumatic things. I have like, it's not that I don't have any reaction, but I really don't have any reaction as like a defense mechanism. I'm in therapy, so you know, whatever, working through it. But yes, this week in particular has been very difficult. And I think it's the struggle of, you know, like I made some joke to Adam and then also people are like, can we just like not work on the third? Like no one's going to be able to focus. even though you are well aware, you're not going to have any numbers or anything until 8 o'clock at night, but there's still that anticipation and that anxious anticipation all day long. And it feels like it's going to be a week of that. And so you're in this place of knowing that it's coming, not knowing what's going to happen, which increases your anxiety and anticipation. But also in the back of your mind, you're like, I can't check out of life because I have stuff to do. And like, I have a job, what do I have to do? The next 7 days are just going to be fucking awful.
And I think that this is one of many times where I wish that my job like actually took me away from the site where all of this news is coming in, right? Like, if my job right now was to take care of my lawn for the next week, right? Like, I would be staring at the leaves on the ground instead of like trying to write a piece with TweetDeck in the next thing over.
Yeah.
You know, and someone's like, close TweetDeck. And I'm like, yeah, I close it. And then I open it again in like 5 minutes. And it is that feeling of like, there's no news, but you just need news, right? That tension, holding that there. And I think the psychological cost of that, like, I'm feeling it in my body. Like, I feel like my body is kind of falling apart.
Mm-hmm. I literally am looking at my heart rate right now, just discussing it, and it's going up. I can see it on my watch, which is also not helpful to be like, oh, look, I'm panicking. And the thing is like, I don't know. I played baseball in college, and I would always be really nervous until the game started. But then once the game started playing, I was more nervous, like, if I was on the bench watching our defense play, because I couldn't do anything to help it. And so I know that even leading up to it on Tuesday, I'm going to not only like throughout the day is going to be horrible. I know I'm going to be sitting there on Tuesday and like, listen, we're all talking about how stressed and how maybe not the best practices. I'm going to have a bottle of whiskey next to me and a glass of minimal ice because I don't want to even like weaken. I want it to hurt. And I'm going to be watching Wolf Blitzer and his team pull up those damn little counties and be like, look at here in Tuscarora. And I'll be like, shit, Tuscarora, we're in trouble. And like, I'm not going to have anything to do. And it's going to be 5 or 6 hours of that.
Right.
And like, I think my defense mechanism is to do exactly what I'm doing right now, which is make jokes. That's always been my, like, how I avoid serious situations. Like, I'll be talking about like my mental health or like my physical health with someone, and they'll ask me a serious question, and I will just crack a joke, and they'll stare at me and be like, but please answer the question also. Like, no.
Well, and my coping mechanism is always to like write about it. So it's just like doing more work. I mean, the other thing too, and this is part of our burnout conversation, is that I think most people know that it's not going to necessarily be the catharsis that we want it to be, right? Like, even if that, like, we get through election day, there's still going to be so much shit on the other side.
Oh yeah.
You know, like, it's not going to be like, wow, it's over. Like, COVID's still here, you know? Like,
somebody, we do a team, our communications team at Overdrive, we do a Monday meeting of like, basically just so all 9 or 10 of us can say hi and like talk about nothing but the dumb movies we watched on the weekend or what show our coworker watched on CBS All Access, which he loves to talk about. And one of the people in our team was like, I just can't wait to get to this year over, like this year done with. And there was a pause, and somebody on our team was like, I just need to confirm, you know, COVID's not just going away on the 31st. And like, everyone started laughing. It's like, cause you're right. It's, and I think that's the, I hope people who read your book aren't looking for like a cathartic answer at the end, because it's like, you're going to feel this. You're going to keep feeling this.
Yeah. But I do think, maybe just to encourage people to
definitely read it. Yeah.
Read or listen to the book. Like, it
don't read this book. Give off the word anyway.
Giving shape to that exhaustion.
Yeah.
Like, having language to describe it is so valuable. And it does feel cathartic in a different sort of way, right?
Yeah, let me give my like unrequited read this book. It's so freaking good. Like, I need to make sure I'm clear on that. I just don't want people to come like tweeting at you to be like, I'm stressed. What's my answer? And you're supposed to know the answer to this.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Like, that's the bad. I don't read my Goodreads reviews because, like, you're just like, why would you do that to yourself? But the people who have been like angry about their the initial article or the book, like, it is like, I thought I was getting like tips, right? Like top 10 BuzzFeed tips on how to
BuzzFeed all,
right? Or angry boomers, or resentful Gen Xers who feel like they're not seen. But like, the thing that I try to do with the book is show that, like, you know, to be a millennial in some ways, it's a state of mind. Like, you can be a Gen Xer and have like the millennial mindset that we've mm-hmm. been describing here mm-hmm. that accompanies precarity. And I think actually a lot of millennials' attitude towards the world around them are actually probably most similar, depending on when your family came to this country, but, or like most similar to our grandparents' generation who had to live through the Depression and then World War II, and were really shaped by continuous precarity. Mm. They did get to live out their last years in like the golden age of American capitalism. So maybe that's coming for us too. We'll see.
I just think about like, my parents were alive during, like, they're still alive, but like during the Vietnam era, like my parents were at Kent State at like, oh. they were students there at the, like during the shootings and everything. And like, but I keep thinking, I was having a conversation with my mom about, like, she said, just like, their time was a lot of unknown and upheaval and everything, but like there was a definitive thing they were all kind of rallying against. And mm-hmm. so there was, you know, like protest songs and protest books and protest art. And I'm just sitting here, I'm like, okay, the pandemic is kind of bringing us all together, and like COVID, but like I've listened to some music that is like, has been created in this time. It's like, there's no like protest song that I can think of that's like definitive for our moment right now, because you'd be protesting like everything. Like, there's a new thing that happens every day where you're like, well, that's the biggest story of the year if this was a normal year.
Well, and the other thing, and this is pointed out in a couple of different histories, but the one book that I find so valuable that's looking at that period and boomers coming up during that period is Barbara Ehrenreich's Fear of Falling. And she points out that one of the reasons that people, like boomers, young boomers, were able to really rebel and push back during that time was because there was a fair amount of security, mm-hmm. right? Like there were jobs. And so people felt like, oh, I could drop out of society and just go protest for 2 years. And then I could still find a job, especially if you have a college education. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's one of the things that we're beginning to understand is like, part of the reason that like there hadn't been this coherent response to like what happened in the aftermath of the Great Recession is people were just so like, they were just scrambling. And it wasn't until Trump came along and forced a response in some capacity, no matter what your situation was, that we really have arrived at this, mm-hmm. this point of like progressive pushback.
Yeah. We'll kind of end here, but I'm curious. Normally we end with like, what do you hope readers take away from the book? But we kind of been talking about that for 50 minutes. But I want to know, I'm curious, and I hope the answer is yes. Have you been able to read anything fiction? I saw
Totally. I kind of goes like month to month. It's a little different. So like, I'll go a month where I haven't been able to read anything, and then I'll kind of reimmerse myself and get back into something. My recommendation is actually going to be Liz Moore's Long Bright River.
So good.
Which, if you like Tana French and like that style of thriller, I think that like quasi-genre fiction is just incredibly useful in this moment. I love quote unquote literary fiction, but it is sometimes just a little bit harder to really envelop yourself. But like, the pleasure of really just being sucked into a book and like having the structure be one that would pull me along with it, despite all of my desires to go check Twitter or whatever, like that was just, it was really beautiful, even though the story is pretty bleak, but just wonderfully told. I cannot wait to see what she does next. So
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Adam Sokol and Jill Grunewald, and presented by Overdrive. For more information, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
Hey there! I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey.
We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of Sleepover Cinema,
our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon.